This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month, the Library of Congress announced its annual selection of 25 movies to be added to the National Film Registry. The films chosen for their cultural, historical, or aesthetic significance include The Bride of Frankenstein, 42nd Street, Gun Crazy, Phantom of the Opera, The Public Enemy, Steamboat Willie, Tootsie, and the hippie biker classic Easy Rider.
This used to be a hell of a good country. I can't understand what's going on with it.
Man, everybody got chicken, that's what happened. Hey, we can't even get into, like, a second-rate hotel. I mean, a second-rate motel, you dig? And they think we're gonna cut their throat or something, man. Like, they're scared, man.
Oh, they're not scared of you. They're scared of what you represent to them.
Hey, man. All we represent to them, man, is somebody who needs a haircut.
Oh, no. What you represent to them is freedom.
What the hell's wrong with freedom, man? That's what it's all about.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's what it's all about, all right. But talking about it and being it, that's two different things.
On today's Archive Edition, we'll hear from the two people who made and starred in Easy Rider, Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper. They played two hippie drifters getting high while riding their motorcycles in search of the real America. Jack Nicholson played their alcoholic lawyer friend. I spoke with Peter Fonda last March after the publication of his memoir, Don't Tell Dad. Dad, of course, was actor Henry Fonda. When we spoke, Peter Fonda was up for an Academy Award for his performance in the film Yulee's Gold, which is now out on video. The roles that you first really became famous for were biker roles. So before we get to some of those roles, how did you first meet Dennis Hopper, who was your collaborator on early films? You even wrote a screenplay together before shooting Wild Angels and Easy Rider.
Right. I met Dennis at the reception to his wedding to a person named Brooke Hayward, whom I'd grown up with and was like kind of my older sister, like Jane. But not really like Jane in the long run. We all kind of got damaged together, you might say. And so at her wedding, I was there. The reception was held at my sister's apartment in New York in 1960, and that's when I met Dennis the first time.
And what hooked you up together? I mean, what did you see in each other?
A certain energy and frustration and the ability to collaborate, to break through that, and the ability to find ideas that were new and different. And fortunately for me, I got turned on to some of the great bits of American art. The artists themselves, their work, the pop art scene, everything Dennis was into, I just absorbed like a sponge. So he was a gateway to lots of cool things that were happening in my life.
Well, you wrote a screenplay together called Yin and Yang, and I think it was that screenplay that led you to Roger Corman. And Roger Corman cast you in his film Wild Angels, which was about bikers, about the Hell's Angels.
Notice how you had to stammer just for a second. It was about, what was it about?
Yeah, what could it possibly be about? Let me think.
Nazi paraphernalia, raping somebody in a church. That's basically what the whole bottom line was.
Well, this was the leader of a Hell's Angels gang. A kind of real switch from previous roles that you had in movies like Tammy and the Doctor and Lilith. What did you think of yourself as being the biker?
Well, I mean, I liked the job I did in Lilith. I thought I fit the bill well. And in my later years now, I'm enjoying hearing that from people. But I didn't want to be cast as the sensitive roles all the time, and that's what my agents had in mind for me. They thought they wanted me to become the next Dean Jones for Disney. I had other thoughts afoot here. I was a bit too radical for that. And so I started to strike out in a different way.
Now, why do you think Corman cast you in the biker role?
I think he saw me as this very rebellious person who didn't give a rat's ass and went out there and just did what was most, I guess, obnoxious, or at least what shook the cage. Whatever would shake the cage the most into any kind of really set in legislative morality. I really believe that abstract morality has no place in our political or our everyday lives. And I mean, arbitrary morality and abstract authority certainly doesn't. So he saw me as somebody who was always watching for something to step on that looked like abstract authority or arbitrary morality. It's been a long time since I've had to talk about arbitrary morality.
So listen, when you were cast in Wild Angels, were you already riding a motorcycle?
Yeah, I'd been riding around a lot with various other glitterati, McQueen and Brando, myself, Ted Marklin, people that...
Oh, boy, it would have been fun to see you and Brando, who had also played a biker, riding around together.
Oh, yeah, actually, he asked me to come by his house one afternoon. He said, come by my house. I left my motorcycle down at Wally Cox's. Would you take me down there? I said, sure, Bud. We called him Bud because that was what he was known as a young man in Omaha. A junior in the Midwestern term is always known as Bud. Instead of Marlon Jr., or Junior, he was called Bud. And I said, yeah, Bud, I'll come by. He said, but bring your Bonneville. I had a Triumph Bonneville. And, you know, I thought maybe a car would suffice, but, oh, sure, you can ride in the back of my motorcycle. As we're riding down Ventura Boulevard, trying to beat the rain, Marlon leaned forward and whispered in my ear, did you hate your father? I thought to myself, that's the strangest question to have come from this dude who's holding on his arms around me. I'm wondering, why does he have his arms around me? What am I in for with Marlon here?
What'd you say?
I just said no. Right. In the long run, Marlon, no. And I talk about it in that way in the book. Uh-huh. An example that, in fact, I knew that I loved my father. I was confused and wondered whether he loved me.
I think it's time to hear a scene from Wild Angels, your first biker film. And now, in this scene, you're at the funeral of a biker played by Bruce Dern, and his coffin is covered by a Nazi flag. There's mm-hmm. a minister delivering a eulogy, which you think is really phony, so you interrupt the eulogy to say this.
Yeah, we don't want nobody telling us what to do. We don't want nobody pushing us around.
I apologize. But tell me, just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. We want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. And that's what we're going to do.
Well, wait, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party.
Yeah! And as you can hear, they are totally tearing apart the church.
I warned you about that one already.
Peter Fonda, your thoughts listening back to this scene?
Far out.
That's groovy would be the other alternative.
No, not groovy, just far out. And, you know, what the heck. You would have to pick that scene. I didn't write it.
Who did?
I can't remember.
How did those lines sound to you at the time? You want to be free to not be hassled by the man.
I thought I had a better way of saying it, but I was reminded that I was playing the leader of a motorcycle gang and didn't necessarily have a larger vocabulary.
My guest is Peter Fonda. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Fonda. Now, there is a poster of you from this movie that you say sold, what, 16 million copies in America or something like that?
Easily, yeah.
How seriously did you take yourself at the time as a biker icon?
I didn't even put those two things together. I was brought into Corman's office. He was over at 20th Century Fox, had a deal making films over there, and he said he wanted to make, and my hair was rather long, and I was considered a weird hippie, and he said he wanted to make a motorcycle movie, a movie about the Hells Angels that wasn't making a statement, which I found to be rather far out, because I think anytime you make a movie about the Hells Angels, you're covering statement all over the place. So I thought, well, let's see if he can do it. I said, I'm in. And eventually I was called. And actually, the first time I was called to play Bruce Dern's part.
The loser.
The loser, yeah. And I said, oh, I can do this one easily. Anyway, it turned out that the fellow who's cast to play the part that I ended up playing didn't know how to ride a motorcycle, so I got the gig. But at the same price, I got to play for being the loser, who's a stiff for about a third of the film.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. When you were young and going to boarding school and private school, you write that you had the image of being a sissy, and for a while you were even called Fairy Fonda. That was in part because you had to play the role of a fair maiden in the Pirates of Penzance at an all-boys school.
Also, the fact that I weighed probably 82 pounds.
Yeah, you were real, like, skinny marink at the time. Not that you ever put on a lot of weight in later life, but anyways, it's a kind of far cry from that image, you know, from the sissy image that you had to, you know, the biker.
Worked.
Did you like that change? Did you find it amusing, or did you take it really seriously?
Well, that particular part of the change I found very amusing. And even writing the script with Dennis, it was a lot of fun and an amusement to it. I was definitely bent to do something different in my life, and I went for it.
The
next film, what are you going to do next? Let me find out if I should chain myself to this chair and handcuff myself so I don't come crawling through the mic.
I have a question about Roger Corman's The Trip, but you'll be spared from any clips.
Roll the clips. I can handle it.
Okay. This is an LSD movie with lots of, like, swirling psychedelic colors intercut in the trip scenes. Now, I imagine you were already tripping a lot yourself when you shot this movie.
No, you couldn't really do that. I think I'd end up looking at the camera and just starting to crack up, thinking these guys are really serious, aren't they?
No, I don't mean while making the movie, but I mean, I don't mean you were high during the shooting of the movie necessarily, but you already knew a lot about acid trips by the time you made the movie, right?
Not a lot, I think. I only took my reputation for consumption far exceeds the actual amount of controlled substances that I ever attempted or tried. But I knew what it was. I knew what it was. I had an altered state several times before Roger and I talked about making a movie about that thing, and I tried to get Roger to go for it, too, so he'd know what an altered state was, because I was very specific, and I said, it's not, you know, about flashing lights and swirling things overlaid on images on film. That's what you see in the discotheques, because they don't know how to recreate it. And Jack Nicholson wrote the script, and Jack's script was absolutely brilliant. He did it all with stock footage, some footage that we would shoot, in a cutting matter. In other words, he made the rhythm of the cuts and what the visual image was against your eyes into an altered state. It was a brilliant thing. And Roger copped to the flashing lights and swirling things, overlaid images of the rest of us, which rather disappointed me. But the good part about it all was first that I got to work with Dennis Hopper, who was in the film in a supporting role, by telling Roger who was not going to shoot some of the images that were really necessary to make something out of it. And Dennis and I went off with the camera and film to the desert and shot stuff of me running through sand dunes and things like that. They didn't intercut very well, but you sure could see the difference in the footage we shot compared to the footage that Roger shot.
Now, how did you and Dennis Hopper decide to do Easy Rider, your own version of a biker film?
Well, as I said, I had been given this as my daily lesson. What it was, I was in Toronto, Canada, in September of 1967, attending a big convention of theater owners and exhibitors and distributors. And at the second day of lunch with 1,200 people, I was up at a big table of glitterati. Now, I had been through all this, the normal stuff of selling a film, talking to the press, so I had a very nice custom-made double-breasted suit and a really cool shirt and tie and no shoes or socks. So everybody would come in to visit me, to interview me, just couldn't take their eyes off the fact that I had bare feet, and they just stared at the bare feet, which was, of course, the desired effect. And actually, the day before, when I was given my lesson by Jack Valenti, he looked right at me as I was sitting down on the floor with the rest of the plebes and said, we have to stop making movies about motorcycles, sex, and drugs, and start making more movies like Dr. Dolittle, which cost $27 million. And I went back to my room. Okay, no more sex, motorcycle, sex, and drugs movie. But I'd come up with this story the night before I said that line of Easy Rider. Called Dennis on the phone. It was 4:30 Toronto time. On the 27th of September, 1967. And 1:30 in L.A. time, and I called Dennis, told him the story that I'd made up, and he said, that's far out. What are you going to do? I said, well, I thought you'd direct it, I'll produce it, we'd both write it and act in it, we'd save some money, and I believe we'd make a movie that would be commercially successful. And that's how it started.
What did you want your motorcycle to look like for the movie?
Just what it looked like. All that steel and all that engine between my legs and that red, white, and blue and star-spangled gas tank, I thought it was like a huge phallic symbol that I'd be riding across the country.
And that's you wanted.
Well, exactly. And Dennis wanted me in white leathers, and I said, no, this is an Evel Knievel. We stay in black leathers. We don't want to count out the S&M crowd from this movie. We want to get as many people in here as possible, and black leather plays a lot better, believe me, Dennis. And so, anyway, I put spurs on even. Very few people realize that I was wearing spurs during that movie. I was trying to tell you we were making a Western that happened to have sex and drugs and motorcycles in it.
Now, time for another scene.
Uh-oh.
In this scene...
This news is getting tighter every time you do this. But I can handle it. I can handle it.
This is one of your scenes in Easy Rider with Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson is an alcoholic lawyer. And in this scene, you're giving him his first joint. You're convincing him. You're convincing him to try marijuana. Let's hear the scene.
Go ahead, George. Light it up.
Oh, no. I couldn't do that. I mean, I've got enough problems with the booze and all. I mean, I can't afford to get hooked.
Huh. You won't get hooked.
Yeah, well, I know, but I mean, it leads to harder stuff. You say it's all right. Well, all right then. How do I do it?
Here.
That's got a real nice taste to it, though. I don't suppose it'll do me much good, though. I mean, I'm so used to the booze and everything.
You've got to hold it in your lungs longer, George.
Yeah, I remember that. Of course, there's these long pauses, and you wonder what's going on. It's intercutting between me and Jack and the looks I'm giving it, because I don't really make a comment about whether the grass is good or bad or getting hooked. I just, look at him and smile.
Now, what did your father, Henry Fonda, think of Easy Rider and your image as, the countercultural movie star who rode a motorcycle and went on, trips of both kinds, the acid and road kind?
Well, I'm sure that he wasn't thrilled with the whole thing, but he knew that I was very serious as a producer and that I had put this thing down as an original story and then co-wrote it with Dennis and Terry Southern into a screenplay.
In movie terms, it made a fortune. I mean,
but he didn't know
good,
that yet.
So, right,
and I knew we would make some money, and therefore mm-hmm. Dennis and I would have a track record, and we could make another motion picture. It was later into it that I realized how far out it would go. And my dad, by this time, by the way, I realized we were going to go to a much broader audience than I figured mm-hmm. originally. My dad said, this is pretty thin here. I don't think people are going to understand what's happening. I mean, we don't know where you're going. I said, well, Dad, why don't you take the trip with us and find out what we find out, discover what we discover? He said, well, that's pretty thin. I mean, where are you going? We need to know so we can take that trip with you. And I said, well, Dennis says, I'm going down to Mardi Gras. I'm going to get me Mardi Gras Queen in the first campfire. Dad said, well, son, that's a little bit thin. I don't think that'll hang in there. I don't think we'll stay with you. And I'm worried for you because I know you've got all your eggs in this basket. And he was entitled to his opinion, which was probably the way that most of the establishment, liberal or conservative, saw the particular movie. But what he hadn't factored in fact, I wish I was smart enough to say that I factored in, was as the flower children and hippies came into being, we had our own language, we had our own art, we had our own poetry, music, our whole morality, our customs. What we didn't have was our own movie. And when Easy Rider popped on, that became our own movie, and that transcended everything else and became the icon that it was.
Peter Fonda recorded last March after the publication of his autobiography, Don't Tell Dad. The Library of Congress just added his 1969 film Easy Rider to the National Film Registry. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.